Welcome to the Rooted in Change podcast.
Hey everyone, my name is Jan and you're listening to the Rooted in Change podcast. This show features European clean tech champions and their solutions to tackle the climate crisis. Today's guest is Nicolas, co-founder and CEO at Prono. Now, over the last episodes, we have often focused on energy and storage solutions. Today is going to be very different because we'll focus on the ocean. When it comes to removing CO2, we often think of direct air capture nowadays. But it's actually our oceans that are the most powerful carbon sinks. Prono is on a mission to restore the ocean's natural ability to capture and permanently store CO2 from the air. We learn more about how that works in just a second. Welcome, Nicolas.
Hello, Jan. Pleased to see you again and happy to be featured on Rooted in Change.
Well, it's lovely to see you again. We just met recently at the HEC Summit, so this is super exciting to have you now on the show. For everyone who doesn't know you yet, maybe let's start with the intro question that I ask all my guests. What's your background? So who are you as a person? How did you end up becoming the co-founder and CEO of Prono?
Yeah, sure. So some short version is, so I'm a sailor, I'm an engineer turned entrepreneur, an MBA. So I was trained as a general engineering in fluid mechanics, hydrodynamics and aeromechanics as well. And essentially, the beauty of life is that I always got to work at the nexus of climate and oceans. Mm-hmm. Actually, just after my engineering school, I got involved in the decarbonation of the shipping industry.
Right.
With a very specific angle. So for 7 years, I worked on innovative wind propulsion technologies.
Right.
So essentially scaling these automated wing sails from scratch up until industrial scale project and going all the way from blank page, pilot demonstration. And we ended up equipping a ship called Canopy. Mm-hmm. That actually transports Ariane 6, the European Space Launch System between Europe and French Guiana. So that was my first, and it was also an entrepreneurial experience because I ended up co-founding a company called Ocean Wings in the process. And essentially, that got me to work into climate. So after 7 years, my role was also a bit shifting more toward management, which I felt less prepared to. So I took a step back, rested a bit, but actually after only 2 months, I took an MBA at INSEAD.
And so then, not so much rest and or rather getting right into it again.
And then also to figure out what I would do, but around that time was the last IPCC report coming out. So essentially the first time that you would see that at the top level of the scientific community, every scientist, they deem that CDR is unavoidable at a relatively large scale because we are talking 5 to 16 gigaton of CO2 to be removed every year by when we reach net zero by 2050, hopefully. And so that resonated with me also because I was exposed to the shipping industry, which is one of the hardest to abate sector and the slowest to do so as well. And so I figured there might be a way in CDR, not only to mitigate the bad thing, but also to actively contribute on the good thing and actively restore ecosystems and restore carbon sinks. Because as you mentioned, naturally the oceans are already sucking up over 25% of our yearly CO2 emissions. So that's just huge. That's more than forests and soils combined. And all too often when we talk about ocean as a carbon sink, mm-hmm. we draw this parallel with what's happening on land, with photosynthesis and plants. Mm-hmm. But on the ocean, it's not how that's happening. It's not thanks to algae. It's simply thanks to chemistry and geochemistry. This CO2 that passes from the air to water because of partial pressure differences. And then essentially what it does when it's in these surface waters is that it builds up, which causes ocean acidification and also CO2 saturation, meaning right. that this biggest carbon sink of ours is becoming less and less efficient over time.
Right. So, and that's the problem that you're tackling in a nutshell, right? Like that sort of that natural process that you just described around
yes.
CO2 being sucked in by the ocean and removed from the atmosphere, and instead, or compared to on land where it happens thanks to plants, and in the ocean it doesn't happen through algae, but sort of the chemical reactions
Yes.
and the chemical background. That process is, well, being decreased, being hindered, being slowed down. Is that the sort of, for in layman terms, the right assessment?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Right. And how do we solve this? What's your approach to tackle this?
Yeah, so essentially the in a way, we can see that as a combined problem, right? We have this ongoing ocean acidification, which is one of the nine planetary boundaries, and the next we are likely to cross. And so, with very little solutions and even less so financement solution for these solutions. So that's one part of the problem, ocean acidification. The other one between being CO2 removal. And so, in a way, we are trying to tackle both with one approach that's called ocean alkalinity enhancement. Now, within ocean alkalinity enhancements, there's actually many ways you can do that. What we do is so we pioneered a unique approach of dissolved carbonate-based alkalinity enhancement from coastal outfalls. Happy to dig into what that means.
Yeah, I think we need to, for everyone who's not familiar with the topic. So walk us th through how does your tech and your approach work in practice, and sort of what's involved.
Yeah, of course. So couple of things. So essentially, when we are talking about ocean alkalinity enhancement, it's kind of a scientific name of essentially restoring an existing carbon sink. So the way to enhance and accelerate this natural CO2 uptake from surface waters is called ocean alkalinity enhancement. Now, as you can imagine, there are a number of ways to do that, but are very different in terms of how they operate, which feedstocks they use, and where they operate. So you have approaches that are the way we segment that is in four different approaches. So you have coastal enhanced weathering, for instance, so people putting olivine, for instance, on beaches and waiting for the olivine to weather. So this is coastal enhanced weathering. Then you have ocean liming. So this is more a theoretical way of adding lime or quicklime, put that on ocean ships in international waters and then spread that. And you have approaches that are labeled as electrochemical or mineral OAE. And these approaches can happen everywhere. In many cases, they happen in coastal areas and in some cases co-located with existing industrial sites. So that's one part of the equation, and the other part of the equation is what type of alkalinity do you add? Because again, there are many different, depending on the chemical species, there also might be differences. But yes, in long story short, the way we do that is dissolved alkalinity. So it's just a stream of water with no particulates inside. And we do that from coastal outfalls. So essentially, what we do is we co-locate with mostly any industrial or utility plant that has already a return flow to the sea, and piggyback on their infrastructure for returning this water to the ocean, because you need very specific infrastructure for quick dilution, and also it's linked with location-specific environmental permits.
Okay, I have a few follow-up questions to make this even clearer for everyone who's listening. But let's start with maybe what you said last around sort of the co-location and piggybacking on existing infrastructure. Because if I, for example, think of water-related tech, it's often that new infrastructure is being built. I'm thinking of desalination, for example, right? Where you build new plants, you take the water from the ocean, and then you, well, desalinate it, so you keep the fresh water and you have the salt afterwards, and there's sort of a whole new plant in place. But what you're doing is you go to existing infrastructure, so production sites that will release their water ultimately to the ocean. But there you piggyback sort of upon that, those existing systems, in order to bring your expertise, your technology in there to deliver that desired effect of restoring the oceans. Is that the correct assessment?
Yes, absolutely. So I think what may be important also to the audience is these systems, because when we talk about industrial co-location or industrial integration, it can be tricky if you start to be site specific. It's not our case. What we do is we co-locate downstream of industrial operations, so and act on the return flow just before it's released to the environment, essentially. And that's the idea behind is that for the integration of our systems to be a no-brainer to our industrial partners, and also for us to standardize our units and be able to leverage learning and scaling effects.
Understood. And the benefit of from this sort of co-location approach is it allows you to be a lot faster in rolling out your tech, right? And it's a lot less asset heavy, I would assume, because there's existing infrastructure. How does that work? Maybe you can give a bit of background there.
Yes, I think so. Absolutely. Our first idea when starting with this approach was exactly what you just mentioned. So in CDR, there's a speed and scale component in a way. So you want to aim for approaches that have the potential for fast deployment and essentially have to rely on approaches that are asset light or infrastructure light at least. And also that piggyback on existing infrastructure, existing environmental permit allows for much faster deployment. Another thing that we discovered later on and that we think is very interesting is essentially by having this approach, actually our CO2 removal activities can be double use. So we can have an offsetting approach to third-party buyers, but we can also have an insetting approach to our coastal industry partners. And that's also super interesting to them because as they are planning long term for their net zero goal, they can already see on the ground how our technology is running and understand how this could contribute to their net zero goal in the future.
Gotcha. Let's stay a moment there with the with what you just said. You mentioned the insetting part of the equation. Now, I think everyone is familiar with offsetting emissions. So, you know, if you fly somewhere and you go to a service that provides you sort of with a service that allows you to offset those emissions so that you compensate your emissions ultimately. But then insetting, I would assume, is the opposite, but how does that work in practice? Maybe you can give a bit of light there.
Yes, absolutely. I think you. So one way to think about that is well, essentially, is the notion of is it within or beyond your value chain? So when you're taking actions on your beyond your value chain, like climate action or this is called offsetting. Essentially, because it's beyond your value chain. But when you're favoring initiatives or in the future, it's relatively new, this approach, but in the future, more and more, we can foresee CO2 emissions approaches could be co-located with industrial sites and potentially fully or partially contributing to insetting goals and thus industrial decarbonation.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I think sort of where offsetting doesn't really reduce the emissions, it's more the insetting part is you're doing better from the start, right? So you co or you integrate probably actually those off the natural practices in your value chains, what I think you just described as well.
Well, I would say, regardless, I mean, the quality of the offsetting would be yet another topic.
Yes.
Of course, but you can offset with very high quality removal. So I would say that's a bit of a different topic, but
Right.
for the corporate players or companies that have a chance to rely on insetting approaches, then that's much more favorably viewed from a carbon accounting standpoint. And also, further to your point, kind of is related to quality, right? Because then you have this project that stands there within your value chain. So it's much easier to check on it regularly and see how qualitative it is.
Okay, gotcha. And a few minutes ago, you said that you wanted to make solutions like yours a no-brainer for your industry partners. Maybe you can expand on that because it's a notion that we often hear in climate tech, sort of it's a good sales argument to say, look, our solution, for example, doesn't cost you anything. This is where all the as a service approaches come from. If we just think of energy as a service, right? Like there's no upfront investment for you. We give you the hardware, and the hardware delivers what you're actually looking for, often, energy related or efficiency gains, whatnot, sort of for free, and you pay for that throughout the years by using that energy. And no CapEx. So that they're very good business models for the clients and lowers their initial hurdles to buy, that I get. In your case, it's slightly different from the outside, at least, because sort of where's the incentive to act? Where's this no-brainer part in the solutions that I just described? Companies need energy, so there's the need, right? That makes sense, sort of right away. What does that need for you? Where's the no-brainer catch for them?
Yeah, so on that, so I'm trying to, so I'm gonna rephrase a little bit and let you know if I understood the question correctly. But essentially, I think you have two levels to your question. What was the incentive for them? So what's in it for them? And then when I say it's a no-brainer, is that from a technical or integration standpoint, it's as easy as can be. And so I believe your question
And
was
I'm
referring
interested
to
in
the,
both, yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
okay. So the second part, as I mentioned, so we are located downstream of the system, requiring virtually no site-specific integration. So we make, I hope there's no noise in the, because of, there's a demonstration here in Paris, as often happens. So I hope it's not a disturbance to you. But yes, in any case, what I was saying is, we want to make virtually no disturbance at all on the industrial process because we intervene downstream of that, requiring again very compact system. We are talking modular system, membrane-based, operating on water, so extremely compact. So most industrial sites have free lands that's already artificialized that we can rely on. And on the first part, essentially, well, that depends, of course, but we traditionally split that between what we call strategic. It's all about synergies and co-benefits at the end of the day. So either these are strategic or operational. So and this depends on the site, the type of industry, but also the contractual setup, so that the incentives would be a bit different if it's a utility company, for instance, that's run entirely by the public sector, or if you have private company operating a publicly owned asset as a utility, right? So that depends. But in general, what we observe is that there's a willingness to contribute to net zero goals, maybe not now, but also trying to figure out which solutions work and which are the ones that could work within one's value chain. More and more, you have a case that when these players, they need to answer to public requests for proposal, then that becomes very competitive. And if for no cost difference, you can propose a solution that's greener, then
Right.
you can unlock multi-year, multi-million euros or dollar contracts. So that's what we are mostly focusing on. And we are also working on the operational synergies, as in savings of chemical products, etc.
Okay, gotcha. And maybe just sort of on finishing the technology part of this episode, are there specific technologies where your or specific applications where your technology works best with, or are you sort of, or is it sectors that sort of are more interested in your solution than others? Have you identified those sweet spot, or is it really agnostic, sort of anything water works? What's your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, if we, so again, depends a bit on what you want to build. What we want to build is something that hopefully paves the way for low cost and high quality CO2 removal globally. And so what we are aiming for is systems that are extremely tolerant to varying water qualities. Because even on one single site, you'd have some. So why not plan for resilience and tolerance across multiple industries. So mostly as long as there's a flow of water to the sea, we can co-locate and operate. Some companies, even in the US, mostly and in Canada, they are working at alkalinity enhancement approaches on rivers. We are not doing that yet because of various reasons. So mostly focusing on coastal sites. But besides that, can be many sites, right? So can be, as we discussed, could be any specific industrial sites, so including glass or steel, but can be also utility companies. You mentioned desalination, that's absolutely correct. Wastewater treatment plants and power plants would qualify as well. And then you have more niche utilities, such as district heating, for instance. But in many coastal cities in the Nordics, but also in the Mediterranean, they use seawater for
Right.
cooling.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, that's a very broad spectrum of potential applications. But I liked how you phrased it sort of as, we can deal with leveling or different levels of water quality, and our system is very resilient. This is why sort of we're quite agnostic and cover a wide range of applications. Then I'd be interested in hearing how far you've already come, because it seems like a very important topic that you're tackling, and one that, at least from my point of view, has been a bit overlooked. Like, a lot of attention focuses on, on land sustainability, so to say, like the oceans. And I think there's huge studies of how much we know about the oceans in terms of how much biomass we understand, or how, what percentage of biomass is already known. And it's a incredibly low number. I think I'm making this up and just guessing, I guess, but I think it's at around 11% or so, which is not a whole lot. Like, it's not a whole lot of species we really understand in the oceans yet, compared to on land. It's very different, and I feel that same logic applies to the focus in climate tech as well. It's often very, solar, renewable batteries, as I mentioned in the intro. Like, there's a lot of storage solutions out there, which are incredibly important. I like not to say that, but it, sort of this is where the attention focuses. So I'd be interested in hearing from you how far you've come already, and maybe also what's standing in the way from your perspective.
Yeah, so many things in your question, but I think you're touching on something super important. So I'm just gonna bounce on it. But I think there's a huge perception issues with the oceans because, also I guess that's also linked with climate crisis. In a way, we are too focused. It's a anthropocentric view of the world. So we are land-based animals, so we are focusing on what happens on land. Although 71% of the Earth's surface is defined by the water, many of what defines Earth as a planet is based on the ocean. So, for instance, the radius of the Earth is defined by the level of the oceans. So there are so many things that are
Right.
defining our planet that are solely based on oceans. And that's so, in many cases, it's overlooked the oceans are overlooked, but I would say also they are misperceived. Knowing that in many cases we don't know them and we just assume that because no one is there, then that just remains this pristine place that is untouched and it's unlimited wilderness. And unfortunately, that's not the case anymore. So that's also something, a very personal realization that I had, because so early in my career, I had the chance to talk to Vendée Globe sailors. So are you familiar with Vendée Globe? Okay,
Well,
but
I am, but
yeah.
my our listeners might not be, so say a sentence or two.
Yeah, of course. So Vendée Globe is quite of a French thing. Actually, it's the most watched sport event in France, but it's starting to export, but not that. So it's very French. So it's a solo-ended sailing race without assistance around the world. So you can think people going alone on a quite large sailing yacht and sailing around the world for 3 to 6 months, depends a little bit. And essentially, while they're doing that, they're just in very remote places. So they are passing by Point Nemo, for instance. So Point Nemo is the point that's most remote to any land on Earth. So you have no land for 3,000 kilometers. Knowing, so essentially, when you're there, the closest human beings to you are those on the International Space Station, which is only 100 kilometers above, as compared to 3,000 kilometers with no one around. So that's the nice part. The less nice part is when you ask these sailors what struck them most during this around the world race is that essentially when they are in this Point Nemo and they think like, just I cannot be more remote than any human beings or human civilization, you still see plastic pollution, for instance. And so that's, I think that's also this kind of realization that it's not only that it's not a space that we need to live there and live untouched, that's pristine. Actually, it's already destroyed, it's already damaged, and the damages are growing over and over. Just one figure on acidification. Seawater today is already 30% more acidic than at pre-industrial times.
Wow, that's quite a bit.
And yeah, so 30% is not a thing. It's trying to reshape entire food chains in the west coast of the US. This additional anthropic acidification caused the entire shellfish farming industry, for instance, to collapse. So now they need to grow oysters in a pH controlled tanks on land until they reach a certain size, and they can then go back to the ocean where the acidity would not kill them, before they can make their shells. So yeah, these are quite big topics, and I think again that's super important, interesting how you framed it, because again many things are linked to how we perceive these issues. But
And maybe
in
just to bounce off on that, what you just said, and I think this is the interesting difference between what you described and where you're heading is. I think we've seen striking images, and I think the story that you told about the sailors is a very good one as well. But we've seen those media images of ultimately plastic or microplastic islands swirling in the ocean, right? And we've hopefully understood how large those islands can be by now. It's like, and they're obviously not supposed to be there. But I think the issue with what you're working on is plastic in the ocean is to a certain degree still a visibly or a visible issue. You can see
Yes.
it, and you can do those water experiments or illustrations where you take out some water out of the ocean, you show how much microplastic you find in the water by filtrating it and so on. With ocean acidification, it's sort of an invisible issue, right? You're tackling something
Yes.
that's not as easy to see. And the example that you gave with the oysters is a very good one because it's such a, I mean, it's a workaround for now that works, but it's not tackling the problem at the root cause, right? This is what you do, and this is where you come in. Instead of moving the oysters and growing them on land and then putting them into the ocean as soon as they are more resilient to the more acidic levels, that's really what strikes me. And this is sort of what I meant earlier with the media perception that you're tackling a sort of one of those unseen issues, which I find super interesting and super important.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we are, in general, humanity is not great at tackling visible pollution, but even worse at tackling invisible pollution, whether that is ocean acidification or CO2 removal or CO2 in the air for that matter. But yes, further to your initial question, so the company is so Prono, it stands for actually is the name of a Greek goddess of the forethought. We set up about 2 years ago with Juan Buceta, who is a CTO of a company, is an environmental engineer, a chemist, and a PhD in process design with strong field experience in water treatment. And essentially, since the last 2 years, we had the chance to craft some partnerships with top-tier academic and private institutions. We completed two lab-scale pilots. We will soon be to announce our first demonstration project. And also we had the chance to recruit a top team of international talent. So the team, we are based out of Paris, France, but we are only four French people out of 15 now. With people coming from all backgrounds. So super, yeah, grateful to have such a diverse and committed team around us on that journey. And we also had the chance to get some nice international re awards from the MIT, from the Monaco Ocean Institute. We were selected last year as a top 100 solution in the contracts in the context of the XPRIZE contest for CDR. There were only two French companies in the selection. The other one, Net Zero, actually was the runner-up. So they were awarded $15 million on that. So yeah, that's only the beginning. As you mentioned, these are big topics, but yeah, trying to make waves and strides in the field.
Yeah, make waves is a good phrase in your space. I like that. And like, look, I mean, this is sort of how far you've come. So what's the big plan then? Where do you want to go? What's your ambition?
Yes, of course. So we will be announcing soon a demonstration project at a partner desalination plant, actually, for the first as a first test. And then what's next is quite typical for a deep tech climate tech startup, as many of the ones that we that you've seen in ARC last week. But yes, essentially for us, what's key is to unlock more partnerships with industrial players for colocation. Build off-take contracts also, and eventually help us deploy more project of larger size. So when we are talking size and CDR, it's always a bit tricky, but what we are aiming for is relatively a mid-sized system. So we are aiming at units that would remove 10 to 50,000 tons of CO2 per year per site. And when you look at just the number of sites, of coastal sites globally, it's just so for instance, just in Europe and just for wastewater treatment plants, you would have 11,000 sites.
So it's really a mass market for you. It's not sort of, one big shiny project that you need to do it to make or break it, but rather it's sort of there's countless opportunities for you.
Yes, yeah, virtually it's yeah, potentially is massive for relevant climate impact by this using this collocation strategy and also with
And
minimal resource use. Yeah.
yeah, which is a model that I hope investors love, but it sounds really good. I asked before also the part, and you mentioned, it's many questions in one, so I'm trying to put just one now. What's potentially standing in the way? So, we talked about the perception issue, and you just laid out your ambitious plans. What could go wrong, or sort of what's hindering you from rolling out even faster?
Yeah, I think to, I mean, in many, again, that's mainly perception issues, I believe. So in general, these techniques are perceived that as less mature or less well understood, I would say, in terms of how they are going to be executed, what's the applicable regulatory framework, how do you precisely measure, monitor, and model these approaches for compliance with high quality certification schemes. And again, and these thoughts were largely true, but the field is also evolving at a very high pace, I'd say. So in general, the field of CDR before 2021 or even 2022 was almost non-existent. And now you see Androids in companies in many continents. You see regulations globally, not only in Europe, unfolding very rapidly to incentivize this approach and also create a regulatory framework as per how they are going to be accounted for. And that's also the case for marine CO2 removal. So now you have one of the leading certification body globally that's called Isometric that certifies approaches such as ours that are semi-closed approaches. So actually what MCDR companies and specifically we as Ocean Kinetic Enhancement from Coastal Outfall Company am I doing is new, that's for sure. But in many cases we rely on pre-existing models because, well, essentially the way oceans act as carbon sinks, we know we are able to
And it's basic chemistry ultimately, right? Like, I think this is the interesting part around a lot of those carbon removal and nature-based solutions, that what you're trying to do there is not bring hardcore, fusion tech to and prove something that hasn't been proven before, but rather rely on those natural principles that are well understood, that have been well understood for ages, but rather bring this to sort of an industrial scale and implement it into the existing value creation streams and thereby correct sort of the issues that we're seeing. I think this is really the game changer for me and what's really exciting about your model.
Yeah, no, it's exactly. So implementing this project, and on the monitoring side, it's mostly about downscaling models. It's like kind of the opposite. You want something that's more targeted and localized. And what was global was already built. So there are challenges there. But again, it's nothing unheard of. And at the end of the day, it's basic geochemistry. Yes.
Nice. And if you could look into the future 3 to 5 years from now, everything goes according to plan, where are you then as a company?
Yeah, so ideally in the next few years, we've proven our technology at larger scale, so in industrial scale in the order of 10 to 50,000 tons across multiple industry verticals and geographies. And that's also in when I, yeah. So, so that's mostly it, because I think that's between now and 2030, mostly it's going to be about like selecting or at least identifying which technology makes sense, how they can be deployed, what are the pros and cons, and then quickly deploy them from 2030 onwards. Yeah. So the idea is to be in a good standing by then, because what's going to matter is then to build a system.
Speed. Yeah.
Yeah. Build a system that's ready to scale and fast deploy. So building everything for fast deployment, if that succeeds.
Yeah, it's really then, I guess, a game of speed and impact, right? That you've proven that you can do it. You can do it at scale. As you mentioned before, I'm going to pick up this no-brainer idea again, how easy it is, both from a technical perspective, but also from a co-value creation perspective for your partners. And then just do it. And, you mentioned the just on the wastewater treatment, the more than 10,000 sites in Europe alone. So I think, that's sort of, there's countless opportunities for you to be involved. So that's really exciting and really impactful, while I guess even branching out into other areas, as you mentioned before, that you're not looking at rivers yet. I think that could also be something probably in the future, right, to expand your offering to that, if that would be something that people demand.
Potentially. Let's see how the science evolves. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, then I'd like to ask you the final question. I started with the you know, sort of how you ended up where you're now and what motivates you to, or sort of your background would, and how you ended up being the co-founder and CEO of the company. And you just described the timelines until 2030, right? And you know, now we're in 2025, still another good 5 years to go. And those timelines can feel both incredibly short. I feel in climate tech and sort of, or scaling up tech maybe in general, and especially deep tech, 5 years or less than 5 years is not a long time. And yet, on a day-to-day basis, and scaling up a startup can feel like an incredibly long time. And you know, you mentioned you just started 2 years ago. Now you have a team of 15, where only four are French. And sort of, the, you know, the, yeah, there you see the difference. There you see the scale up journey. So, I'm wondering, in a nutshell, what is it that makes you get up every morning and do the work that you do, despite, you know, the big challenges that you're facing?
So I get this question quite a lot, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure it's about motivation because motivation wavers, if that makes sense. So you cannot maintain a very high level of motivation always, every day, every single hour of the day, I believe. So I think it's
Now
also
I'm
kind of
interested
down.
where your answer goes. If it's not motivation, what is it then?
Yeah, I think it's resilience and consistency. So I think it's at the end of the day, it's about building the systems for yourself as an individual and for a company or any initiative you're working on, building the systems that ensure that even though you may not be as motivated as you wish you'd be, and bringing because it cannot be the case always, that then you're able to execute and to stay aligned and focused. So recently I had the chance to meet very inspiring people. So climate change mitigation advocates from all around the world, people who've and that also completely destroy this narrative that some people like we care only about the climate change only on the Western world, because you see these people from third world countries being stricken by droughts, being stricken by typhoons, being stricken by you name it. And essentially, what I got for them is this sense of hopeful responsibility. As you say, the challenge is huge. We don't know if we're going to succeed, but we need to have hope that by repeatedly doing the right thing, then there might be a way out with a positive outcome.
I like your framing that, you know, especially in those times that we're experiencing now, which I feel are relatively turbulent compared to other times that at least I've lived through over the last 30 plus years, that resilience is the key term. And I liked how you phrased it as it's about building the right systems. So the likelihood of you getting it right and systematically getting it right, not just you, but the wider team, increases and is ultimately sort of compound. I think this is what you're after, right? Because what we're coming from is basic chemistry and well-known principles, but now you're rolling this out globally to, you know, to oceans to do good and combine this sort of with this engineering heavy challenge and tapping into sort of the unknown things that haven't been done before and things that are just evolving fast in the whole CDR market, as you've more CDR system, as you mentioned before. So I think this is really a nice connotation that it's about the system that you, as a founder, and the team surrounding you can build to increase the likelihood of getting it right and ultimately really making a huge difference to oceans and us as a the planet.
Hopefully again.
Well, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. This was a very inspirational and lovely chat. Thank you so much for making the time. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, all the best for the upcoming weeks, months, and years.
Well, thank you so much, Jan, for having me.
It's a
Bye.
pleasure. Bye bye.